Okay, gang, let's go ahead and come to order. Okay, great. Yeah, we've got some really good stuff to do today. We will not be doing a reading quiz. Instead, oh, I know, you're disappointed now. Like, I'm so ready for it. We are going to do, we're going to take the next step and kind of do something in groups where you, in groups, you'll be producing a paragraph-length answer to a question that's like a short, small group discussion question. It'll probably be a full credit experience for everybody. I mean, theoretically, if a group does a really horrible job, I would give them fewer points. But my experience with the group writing, group effort, is that, you know, you come up with some interesting stuff. And then we'll echo all that writing back to everybody, right? Because then you get to kind of see how different groups approached it. You'll probably see some answers that you say were a little better than others. And we'll start to talk together about what it means to write good philosophy, you know. And so that's kind of the direction we're going. So we'll still come back to doing reading quizzes occasionally. You should always be ready for that. But as we said at the beginning, you know, coming in with a competent knowledge of the reading is crucial. It's important. It's really, you can actually make progress. You'd be shocked to know that as an undergraduate, occasionally I went to class without doing the reading, and I still thought I'd learned something. But you know, it really does help to do the reading. But it's kind of like, you know, if you buy into this idea that I'm your philosophy coach, which I kind of like the idea of. I don't know if it works for you. Then you know, doing the reading is like showing up with you know, you're the right clothing. You know, it's like you haven't quite done philosophy yet. You've got your shoes laced up and you're ready to do something. So I'm kind of excited to get into that next phase and start to read some of your writing. I should have this in print, but Emma?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. Jillian? Shannon? Great. Molly? Right, good. Aaron? That's right. Ryan? Great. Colton? Good. Harry? Good. Julia? I'm sorry, I'm losing nicknames here. Thomas? Sorry. Kimberly Forrester? Great. Elizabeth? Great. Nathan? Great. Gus? Good. Joe? Great, Joe. Matthew Lee? Great. And Paul? And Cassidy? Great. Matthew? Good. Jack? Kayla? Lauren? Right. Lauren? Right. You're Kayla?
Oh, sorry.
What's your name?
Hannah.
Okay, good. That's good. Alana? Alana? Yeah, good. Nicole? Good. Hannah. Hannah? Good. And Nash? Okay, great. All right, so let's get to our work. Before we get to the chapter, which, you know, I'm really excited about this week, as I told you in the focus notes, we have two readings, not so long, that give you overviews of happiness. So we're going to drill down in the coming weeks to much more discrete kinds of research, but these two readings today and Thursday are efforts by authors to give you kind of an overall theory or overall view. In this case, you're getting Jonathan Haidt, who's a moral psychologist, and he's going to give you what I'll call for your notes if you want to start taking some notes. Today we're going to look at robust findings and structural features of a happiness theory. And robust and structural. So we've already looked at structural issues in happiness theory. The issue of objectivity versus subjectivity is a structural issue, right? It's deep. It's going to be basic to the theory of happiness you develop. Likewise, Haidt is going to introduce us to some things that are, what I mean by robust is these are research findings that are widely replicated. They seem very stable, and they seem very suggestive for theorizing. So the subjective-objective thing was really more of an abstract thing. There might be empirical research to bear on that, but now we're moving into empirical robust findings about happiness that are pretty basic to thinking about happiness and happiness study. So before we get to some of those findings and then your group experience, which is going to be about 15 minutes right about in the middle of the class, I want to say something about, this is kind of on the level of method here, something about what it means to have a construct or a theory. So this is something that maybe some of you have seen before in another class with me, but it doesn't take that long, but it involves giving you a picture. What does it mean to have an empirical theory about something? Because philosophical theories use empirical theories. Philosophers do empirical things. Sometimes we don't actually do experiments. We let other people do them. But sometimes philosophers do experiments. But philosophical theories have some relationship to empirical theories. So let's get a model for empirical theories. And this is the picture that I want you to draw in your notes. So model, construct, theory, whatever word you want to use for that. My theory of happiness is going to be a theory, a kind of theory in this spirit. And so what we get from reality through observation, experiment, survey, and happiness studies survey research is pretty predominant. What reality gives us is some data. And then what we get from our model, what a model or theory is really best thought of as a bundle of claims or hypotheses. And theories generally don't live or die by any one hypothesis. If a theory is complex enough, it can have a bunch of hypotheses that define it. But the hypotheses should be, they don't have to be, but they often are empirically confirmable. You can have a hypothesis that's a priori, but generally in an empirical model, your hypotheses are going to generate predictions. And then what we do is we compare data and predictions, right? And so confirming an aspect of your theory is about figuring out what the theory predicts should be true, and then going out to reality and asking it that question to generate data that you think is appropriate to confirming or disconfirming your theory, right? So this is just a general, kind of a general pattern, general model. Does that make sense? Can I get the nonverbal going? There's a couple of well-received ways of picturing scientific theory, and this is one that I'm partial to. Two things I like about it, and then I'll just kind of ask you to keep it in your mind as we get a lot of empirical theories. I want you to be kind of thinking that this is what they're doing. I think this is a really good approach. But two things about this model that you should think about or note. One is you'd never get a direct. The data that comes from reality is not a direct read of reality. You have to impose a structure on reality. Maybe you write a survey that asks people certain things and not other things. You see, when we question reality, it's selective. That's kind of the point for your notes. We ask certain things. Data isn't a direct reflection of reality. It's a reflection of a question we put to reality. And so we can always worry about whether the question was put the wrong way or includes a kind of hidden bias that misses something important. Second thing, so that's the first thing, is that we don't look at reality directly. We look at reality through experiment and observation surveys, questions we put to it. Second thing is you never hold I don't think, now there are philosophers who would disagree, so don't take my word exclusively. But you never really hold the theory up to reality like a picture. So the point for your notes is you never validate your theory by holding it up to reality. You do step back from your theory and say, hey, is this theory working? Is it pretty good? Is it leaving things out? And you take your theory out for a test drive and you might decide it's missing a few things. So that's a kind of comparison you make, but it's not an empirical scientific comparison. The point is you're always building your theory through this cycle of activity, generating predictions from hypotheses, comparing them to data, and you should always be worried about the indirectness of this. Yep. That's just part of the game. Scientists don't confront, in my opinion, as a philosopher, scientists do not, nobody confronts reality directly. Everybody experiences reality through some set of filters, either the kinds of senses we have, the kinds of cognition we have. You know, there's a long story here, as you might imagine. The point, so this is kind of a picture of empirical, make sure the label is on this in your notes, a picture of empirical theory building. Yeah. And we won't only look at empirical theories here, we're going to look at other kinds of things, but there's a lot of research in happiness studies, and this is a nice way to think about it. Okay? So with that in mind, let's turn to some of these big research results that I'm calling robust and basic. I mean, that should pretty high praise. Oh, I'm sorry. I always forget to gloss this. Some of you have read Jonathan Haidt. How many former ethics students in here? Yeah. I should have glossed the elephant and the rider metaphor. Do you remember that, Laura? From ethics? Remember the elephant? Let's see. Can you help me with this one?
The elephant is like
good start.
Just kind of let the elephant go, and it would be good, but it would be better if the human kind of dragged it sometimes. But not
right. So you're getting the basic idea. The point for your notes is the elephant refers to automatic cognitive processes, which are evolved. They're efficient. They're fast. Flight and fight would be an example. The rider symbolizes self-conscious, self-reflective control. That's when you're thinking about something self-consciously. You have a thought in your head. How am I doing? What's going on? Where am I going to go after class? You know, the thought is in your head. Automatic responses are automatic. They don't require self-conscious, controlled thought. We're going to learn more about this distinction, but psychologists sometimes refer to it as system one versus system two. System two is the automatic one. System one is the self-reflective one. So remember, this is a metaphor or model for consciousness. And so put it in your notes, put it next to Plato's model, which we talked about already, right? That was where consciousness is a charioteer. That's the rider part. You know, the charioteer is self-conscious reason. Holding reins on two horses, which are, you know, represent desire and emotion, right? So in Plato's metaphor, reason's in control and aware of everything. Put that in your notes. In Plato's metaphor, introspection is like a flashlight. You know everything that's in your mind. Reason sees everything. That's the part of the classic Greek model of reason. But in the contemporary psychological model of consciousness and cognitive psychology and other cognitive fields, the model that's much more predominant is that reason is one kind of thing we do. It's very expensive. When you're thinking about things, expensive, in other words, it's cognitively expensive. When you sit there and think about a problem, you know, you never know. A predator might come and eat you, right? In other words, when you're thinking self-consciously about something, you're using all of your mental attention to do that, or most of it, right? But in the new model, you know, we're more aware, because we know much more about how the brain works, we're more aware that a lot of what's going on in our lives is actually happening pretty automatically. And some of these elephant responses, the elephant represents this automatic cognition, some of those responses, so what we want to know is whether those, one thing we want to know is whether the elephant part of us is helping our happiness or hurting it, right? And the elephant represents automatic responses. So how do you affect those? If you found out that you were doing something without thought that was hurting your happiness, let's say you had a compulsive disorder, how would you change that? Can you change automatic processes? Do you change them by thinking about them? You know, so those are questions that are out there. But that's kind of that distinction between elephant and rider. And I'm sorry, you know, you would have been reading along and hear him refer to the elephant and not know what that means. So, okay, let's get some of the major structures out. One of the places to look for research on happiness is the pleasure response that we have. And this is often referred to, though the dopamine is not the only thing going on, it's often referred to as the dopamine cycle. And what do we learn in this chapter about the dopamine cycle. What do we learn about the ability of our ability to get pleasure from successive pleasurable experiences? So I've been using the example of ice cream sandwiches, right? I'm going to keep using that example. I mean literally ice cream sandwiches most of the time. So you eat one ice cream sandwich, you get some pleasure from that. Do you guys like ice cream sandwiches? Okay, good. You should. You eat a second one, there's just going to be a diminishing pleasure. The graph of your pleasure response is going to be diminishing. Eventually it's going to go negative because you're going to get sick and you're going to be throwing up ice cream sandwiches. And it's a pretty cool thing. I'm tempted to go into some of the experiments that Davidson does. He's one of the more famous researchers on this. He's mentioned on 83. Basically, anytime you find a solution to a problem, let's say you're searching for food, let's say you're trying to study to get ready for a test, anytime you find a solution to a problem about something that's going to bring you pleasure, you will get pleasure from it. But the next time you solve that problem, you'll get less pleasure from it. So, you know, imagine your ancestors hunting for food. They come up with a neat trick. They figure out a good place to hang out to get some food. Maybe there's fish there. Maybe there's animals that go by there. Get a pleasure response from that. They're getting some dopamine from that. Wow, we figured out a neat trick. So they go back the next week. It's still pretty good. I mean, you're getting food. This is great. The point for your notes is that you are designed to receive smaller and smaller shots of dopamine from each of those experiences. You're designed to have diminishing returns from the pleasure cycle. Can anybody think about, so that's the point, get that in your notes. Can you think about why that makes sense, given what kinds of, given the, what you know about the kind of creature you are and where you came from?
Like, if you get something consistently, then it becomes constant in your life, so your pleasure will automatically diminish because it's something that you're used to.
Yeah. I mean, suppose nature designed you to enjoy sunsets, and you just always got intense pleasure from sunsets. It never diminished. You know, that could be a problem for your survival, right? I mean, nature does. It's a really interesting theme in the course. You know, does nature really care about whether you're happy? We're pretty sure nature cares about whether you have kids, right? We're not sure how much nature cares about whether you're happy. And so it makes sense, put it in your notes this way, the diminishing returns from dopamine makes sense if given evolution, right? And so that's the first thing, is the pleasure cycle. Second thing is the adaptation principle. And this is huge. We're going to read research on this. The best way to picture it in my mind is with a baseline that represents kind of your baseline of happiness, and a positive and a negative. And what the adaptation principle says is that all affect states return to a baseline. We're talking about HS here, right? Happiness, state happiness. All affect states return to a baseline. So we actually have research on different kinds of experiences people can have and the pleasure profile of those experiences, right? So it's a function. And so we know, for instance, that a new car, on average, produces elevated pleasure for about, how long would you guess?
6 days.
Don't buy a new car. I don't recommend you ever buy a new car.
It's not that long.
How long?
Not that long.
It's not that long. Yeah.
I'd say 6 days.
Only 6 days?
I'm not.
The research I've read says 3 months. So remember, that's a savoring issue.
One after like a week.
Yeah, it only worked for a week for you?
Yeah.
I'm never buying a new car again. It's a bad idea. So remember, savoring is this ability to get pleasure from this. So you might reasonably ask yourself, you might reasonably think, I bet I can get 6 months. Just let me try. I just want to try. Give me a chance. So is this a good thing or a bad thing, that adaptation principle? Good. Again, it makes sense that we're designed this way, right? So you win the lottery, you go back to your baseline. You lose a limb, you lose your sight, you experience, well, we'll talk about different kinds of negative experiences. The point, make sure this is in your notes somehow, these curves are different. So, getting your car window smashed and your bike stolen out of your car, which sadly happened to me a couple of years ago, that was a bummer. Yeah, that really, I think it took me a couple of days to bounce back from that. It's kind of ridiculous. Is it a good thing or a bad thing? Again, do you see the imprint of nature in this?
It keeps us from being distracted by one thing for too long.
Right. We've already talked about what would happen if the sunset just kind of got all your attention, right? Woo! I mean, you kind of wonder what it would be like to be a creature. Like, but what if you were like, you know, what if you had the same thing on the other side? So, you know, something bad happens and you just sit by the river and cry, you know. It's just those people in our past didn't leave ancestors, right? I mean, you guys are the descendants of people who have this kind of profile going. Yeah, that's a neat way to think about it. Like a distortion of these patterns or these curves function. We have names for some of those distortions in that. Yeah, addiction would be an example, because all of a sudden you're just off to the race. You're trying to get pleasure out of 20 ice cream sandwiches, right? In fact, the next big concept, the hedonic treadmill. It relates exactly to that. The hedonic treadmill refers to the self-defeating effect of trying to beat the adaptation principle. This would be a good opportunity for small group discussion where you compare notes on times when you gave it your best shot, tried to beat the adaptation principle by just eating more ice cream sandwiches. Let's just keep doing this. Not getting as much pleasure from it, but, you know, maybe I'll just keep doing it. So the hedonic treadmill tells you that given that adaptation is true, you will not be successful, like trying to outrun a treadmill, you will not be successful in trying to beat the adaptation principle. Because you can't keep up the quantity for at least a lot of pleasure. Okay? Now let's take a moment. I don't see you guys writing this. So, do you think everything adapts? So far we've been talking about material pleasure, new cars, restaurant meals, sex, ice cream sandwiches. Think everything adapts? I don't mean those things together. I mean, you know, one and the other. Yeah. Does everything adapt? What's your hunch? We're going to learn more about this. I just want your hunch.
Well, the article talked about how, like, when more severe, like, traumatic events happen, it might take longer, but you do, like, return to at least near to where your baseline was.
Yeah, this is, I'm glad you hedged on that. There's a little bit of uncertainty in the research. Maybe somebody wants to get more of this. When we get to the specific studies, you'll find some researchers claiming that some negative things don't quite return. So my example, I think I remember reading some research on this, I'm not sure, is parents losing a child. That's like one of the hard, I'm getting some nods, that makes sense, right? It's one of the hardest things to return. There's some people who say that the paraplegic doesn't get back to the baseline. On the positive side, any hunches or guesses or hopes? I've given up my hope about ice cream sandwiches. I tried that. Doesn't work. Any hopes about what kinds of pleasures might not adapt?
I think of, like, the idea of, like, being around and getting married, and you get to that honeymoon stage. I think that's kind of like adaptation, like,
right.
Camp over that, like,
right.
Intense attraction.
That does, and there's research on that. That does happen.
Yeah, but people still can, like, well, they say they can still be in love.
Right. Well, you know, you think about love, that's kind of the high-stakes game. You know, you think about friendship. I mean, relationships are a big category. We're going to spend 2 or 3 class days later in the term on research on relationship and happiness. So think you've got friendships, you've got family relationships, you've got love relationships. So, yeah, that's a big bundle, and you've got a good hunch. It may be that relationships don't adapt. One speculation, I haven't read research on this, one speculation is that it's because it's a moving target. People are moving targets. You're always changing. So if you keep liking your friends, you get new material every year. Isn't that wonderful? Because they do goofy things, or they do new things, or they, you know, they're a year older, and you celebrate another year, and you remember your past. And so, in other words, there's an evolving story, as opposed to our poor little ice cream sandwich, right? Which just is what it is. $6 for $1.69. What do you expect? Right. So. I mean, you can't get much for that. So yeah, we'll be on the hunt. Put it in your notes. Put it in your, keep it in your mind. We'll be on the hunt for things that don't adapt. Maybe other abstract things like meaningfulness, having a sense of purpose. Maybe those are candidates as well. Okay, good. Okay, let's see where we are. I want to get you guys to do some philosophy. So there's another big theme in this article, which we're going to return to after you do your group exercise, and it's this distinction between internal and external strategies. Can we just gloss that together real quick? He starts the article with it, and then he gets back to, you know, the Buddha and Epictetus, and you read about all that. What are internal versus external strategies for happiness? This is a big distinction. Can we just make sure that's in your notes? What is an internal? What are internal strategies? Internal versus external strategies. And then at the end of the hour, after you've done your group work on a different topic, we're going to come back to this. I just want to put it out there and make sure we get it in your notes. Anybody want to help me with this? Yeah.
I think you're saying like internal strategies are things that you have control over, like your behavior or your mindset, which you can
good.
Go out of your way to work on to improve.
Mm-hmm.
That might improve your happiness.
Things you have control over, make sure that's in your notes, right? Good. Another way to put the same point would be to say that internal strategies involve changing your relationship to the world rather than changing what you get from the world. Does that make sense? Changing your relationship to the world, and as you change your own internal relationship to the world, your expectations, your hopes, your anticipations, you adjust those based on what you see in the world versus external strategies which involve making yourself happier by getting things from the world, from the external world, that you think are going to make you happy, like a new car and someone to love and, you know, stuff like that. Okay, so we're going to come back to that because I think after you do this exercise, you'll be in an interesting position to maybe make some observations about that. So let's see. Let's make sure we got some of the main things out there that we wanted to at this point. A couple of details, maybe not, you know, one way to think about adaptation is that we're sensitive to small changes rather than absolutes. So, you know, you get, it's a little warm out there, you step out of the College Hall building after class and you get, oh, this is annoying, it's a little too warm for me. Small change, and you react to it a lot. But big changes, like losing some of your mobility, you actually kind of readjust. We're more sensitive to small changes than absolute. Okay, I think that's most of what we need to get you to do this exercise. Now, what I'd like you to do is get to page 87 with me if you have the text, and let's just review this Bob and Mary comparison. So we've had a bunch of fictional people. We have Pat and Lee and Bob and Mary and all that, so... So, let's see, what do we know about Bob? What do we know about Mary? Anybody help us out with this? Just read off from the page.
Bob is 35 years old.
Sure.
Single, white, attractive, athletic, earns $100,000 a year and lives in Southern California.
Good.
Highly intellectual and spends his free time reading and going to museums.
What a guy.
Mary and their husband live in snowy Buffalo, and they earn combined income of $40,000. Mary
wow.
is 65 years old, overweight, black, and plain in appearance. Highly sociable and spends her free time mostly in activities related to church. She's on dialysis for kidney problems.
Okay. So he chose each of those characteristics on purpose, right? Because each of the characteristics of Bob and Mary has research behind it, which supports the claim that Mary would be the happier person. Mary has meaningfulness in her life. She has relationships. We don't know about the rest about Bob, but we're supposed to just go with what we see there, you know. So don't ask, you know, well, does Bob have friends? You know, okay. We're just judging based on this, these factors. Which one would you predict is happier? And I think what's puzzling here, I hope it's worth your time in groups, is that a lot of us were raised to be like Bob. I mean, you can't raise somebody to be white, but there is a slight advantage to not being a discriminated group. It's not a huge, white people aren't really happier, much happier than black people, but there is a disadvantage to being part of a discriminated group in your happiness. There's a slight disadvantage. The thing is, we tend to think the 100,000 a year, we tend to think all those things would make Bob happier. There's even research on the tendency for people to think Californians are happier. Isn't that fascinating? We tend to believe that people in California are happier than people in Nebraska. I have some good news for you, if you don't live in California. It's not true. I find it hard to imagine myself. I can't imagine being happy in Nebraska. But that's an illusion. That's something that this... So the puzzle here is, why do we raise our kids to be like Bob when the research suggests Mary is happier? And I want you to get at that by, when you get into groups, I'd like you to actually take a little time to read through this page and the next page, because he talks a little bit about that. He gives you some clues. But the question for your group is, you're going to produce a paragraph, and my question to you is, why are so many people in the culture focused on raising their kids to be like Bob when it looks like Mary has more of the components of happiness in her life, according to research? I think that'd be an interesting thing to try to express. So, the way you'll do this at a practical level is by going one person in your group. We have a bunch of laptops, so we'll make sure there's at least one laptop in each group. The person who's writing it up would go to this form. Small group discussion report. And then you just, you know, you give click on all the people who are in your group. And then I suggest you write the paragraph in a different application and just paste it in. That way, you know, you kind of know. It's just people find it easier to do it that way. And so you've got about 15 minutes. I want you to give, you know, I'm going to recommend, you do it however you want, recommend that you give 3 to 5 minutes to kind of individual study and reflection, kind of take some time, read through those couple pages. Maybe then you kind of take 10 minutes to produce the paragraph, and maybe 5 of those you're having a real active discussion. Maybe you're somebody's taking notes. There can be like one or two people who helps the person who actually writes the paragraph. Probably you don't want the whole group trying to write the paragraph, right? They've been in situations like that. Let's start now, and we'll give it 15 minutes, so about 10 after 4, and get into groups, introduce yourself, make sure you know who you're talking to, and then have a pretty good discussion. See if you can produce a paragraph that answers the question well, and then, you know, maybe even some insights. Maybe that would be, we'll see what the results are. I'm going to echo all the writing from both sections back to you so that we can kind of take a look at it on Thursday. Okay, so go ahead and get started. Thanks. Turn your chairs, take your time, you have 15 minutes here, it's not a rush. Get happy by having money if that money allows you to buy things that are associated with social status. So it's a complicated thing there. And again, it brings us back to internal versus external strategies, because one strategy would be to say, get the money and buy into the status that it gets you, or you know, you might find just because on average money doesn't lift people's happiness, it could be that you find a way to use money that does. You know, the typical ways that people use money to increase their happiness at upper ends of the income scale don't work. It's not the consumption that's doing it. Any thoughts on that? We're going to come back to this topic, but there might be ways to spend money that actually does work. A, because you buy into social status, so you really get off driving a Jaguar around. Or B, you spend your money in ways that get you involved in happiness makers that don't adapt, like meaningfulness. So maybe you spend some money to become philanthropic, you know, and that actually might be a happiness maker, whereas spending the money on a second Jaguar, it's like trying to eat a lot of ice cream sandwiches to make yourself happy. So paying attention to what adapts and what doesn't adapt is really important. Okay, let's see, I'm going to keep my timing here. Good, we're doing okay. All right, let's get to this internal versus external thing. Well, one more thing, two more things. We're going to read a lot about relationships. Relationships, put it in your notes, are a good candidate for something that might not adapt. We talked about why, because they're moving targets. And the choice. Choice, I put a positive and a negative by. People assume that having more choices is always going to be better. And there's really interesting research on this. Maybe some of you have read this. Yeah, we used to read Schwartz's book, Paradox of Choice, in the course. So here's the main claim for your notes, and we're not going to spend a lot of time on this. There's research that suggests that having lots of choices could diminish people's satisfaction with their choice. So one of the classic experiments I'm aware of in Schwartz is an experiment in which subjects are asked to choose from a range of jams in a store. You've heard this one? Yeah, good. And can you do it? Do you remember it?
Yeah.
Yeah, good.
Oh, okay, so it's like if you go to the store and there's like three jams and you choose, let's say, like the strawberry one, you're more likely to be satisfied with that one because you only had two other options, whereas if you had like 30 different jams you could have chosen from, you might be like, oh, well, I didn't like this one, which I should have bought for like one.
Yeah, good. You're giving us both the results and a plausible explanation, right? So the result itself is that people who choose the jams from the larger array, when we ask them later how happy they are with their jam, they're less happy than the people who chose from a smaller array. So that's the direct empirical result. And then she offered the explanatory suggestion, right? That maybe there's, you know, how to think about why that is. One way that Schwartz talks about it, and this might be a nice distinction for your notes, I don't think he uses these terms, you tell me if I'm wrong. Schwartz talks about maximizers versus satisficers. Some of you have run across this. Can anybody do this for me? Yeah.
Yeah, so a maximizer wants to get the most benefit absolutely. So they'll go to all ends of the earth to figure out which of those 30 jams will bring the most satisfaction.
Yeah.
Even if it takes them, you know, a day or 2 or 3
seconds. Right.
The satisficer. They'll know that, hey, I like strawberry. I'm going to go out and pick strawberry. I'm going to go strawberry.
Yeah. So do you know who you are? How many of you are satisficers? How many of you are maximizers? Same as last class. Raise your hand if you're a maximizer. I'm not sure. Yeah. It's about as in last class. There's some research, and this is a little soft. I won't say this is a robust result, right? Today I was telling you we've got a lot of robust results to talk about. There's some research that says that satisficers are happier. Now, I know a maximizer, my colleague Kirk Bessemer, Dr. Bessemer, he's a maximizer. He swears he's happier being a maximizer. Now, these results are consistent with that possibility. And these are general results. On average, people might be happier being satisficers. My friend Kirk might be happier being a maximizer. And we're going to talk about this again, but one of the interesting things with research results is that they don't always tell you where you are in the research. They tell you on average something, you know, satisficers are happier. But anyway, we'll get into that methodological issue later.
Do you think that satisficers are more likely to try new things?
That's a good question. I don't know. That could that there's a neat term for that. Neophilia is the tendency to like new things, right? And you might wonder about that, right? Do they buy their happiness at a price of maybe not trying new things? I don't know. That's a good question. Yeah. Okay. Last thing we need a little energy for this. So let's do it. Let's talk together about internal versus external strategies, right? So remember, you already have this in your notes. Internal strategies for happiness are strategies that involve changing your relationship to reality, changing your attitude, changing your expectations. External strategies involve changing what you get from reality, going out and getting things from reality. So what I'd like you to do with me for about 4 minutes, 5 minutes here is let's think together about what, you know, it's not going to be an either or. We're not going to choose one to the exclusion of the other. But let's think together about what might be advantageous or disadvantageous about each strategy. Let's just try to scope out what we're anticipating is potentially valuable or problematic about each strategy. So just take a minute. Yeah, good. You're already ready? Hang on. Yeah, what do you think? Kick us off. Yeah, there might be non-adapting external goods. I'm going to dress up your point in a little bit to make it a little more general. You know, relationships might be an example of a non-adapting external good. You know, we've been saying ice cream sandwiches are a losing strategy. They are. Trust me, I've tried just eating a lot of them. It doesn't work. But things that don't adapt might. Okay, so that's a positive. Can we get some positive and negatives on either side? Yeah.
I was going to say, external strategies are limited.
Many adapt.
Yeah.
Yeah. Many external goods adapt. Yeah, Joe.
I think Wayne's the internal strategy would be the mainly loss of humanity. I think, like Stoics say, suppress your emotions, suppress your feelings. That's a big...
Yeah.
You kind of constrain that curve from going really low or really high.
There's a lot of worries. You're identifying a bunch of worries here of that maybe just getting over things isn't a good strategy, because maybe you're dampening your capacity to experience a range of emotions, right? So put it down as a suspicion in your notes. You put a question mark by it if you're not sure. You could put an exclamation point if you think it's really an insight. It's an open question. It could be that internal strategies... there's a bunch of ways of saying this. Decrease the range of emotions, the intensity of emotions. They can involve, I don't think that's true, by the way, but I'll get back to that another day. They can involve maybe a withdrawal. The Stoics were sometimes referred to as men of stone. That doesn't sound like a good thing. I have a friend who has a lot of control about her appetite. In one sense, that gives her a positive. She's not a victim of her appetites for food. On the other hand, she limits her food to a very small range of food. I mean, I wonder if, like, maybe having a lot of control, put it in your notes this way, having a lot of control sounds like a great thing, but what if it limits the range of experience? A positive thing about internal strategies is that they are self-dependent. You don't, by definition, they're things you can do that don't depend upon others. And so they have a kind of, that's a positive thing. To the extent that I can make myself happier with an internal strategy, it has the virtue that I don't need money, I don't need to depend on other people, I just need my own resources. So, so that's kind of fine. Others, we have some other pluses and minuses? Yes, please.
I think in some ways internal strategies can be more longer lasting, maybe, or they're less inclined to decay than the external strategies.
Yeah, I think does that sound plausible? What do you guys think? Yeah, I mean, if it's something you do to change yourself, it might be like a change that would be, that you could maintain. Whereas external things come and go, right?
Just going off that, my thought was like internal is more core values, like so it's self-dependent, like you're saying, but it's your core, and then external would be like, it would be like changing your surroundings or something that's more out of your control and only case by case rather than finding the solution right at the root of where it's coming from.
Good, right. It's a good thing to associate internal strategies with values, because values might be a source of happiness. Believing in a value, having meaning in your life because you stand for a value, that can be a very sustaining source of happiness. I made a note here to reference Calcutta sex workers. You might be worried. You might be worried about the lack of external goods in a person's life. Well, that maybe that's the second point. Let's leave that aside. Okay, guys, I think we should break there. Thanks for your attention. See you on Thursday.